Lord Simon, ladies and gentlemen, I am very happy indeed to be here to see and to address this splendid meeting in this historic hall. I am leaving to subsequent speakers most of the detailed aspects of our movement and of what we stand for, and I want, in what I have to say, to confine myself to the most general aspects of the whole problem. Man, like other meat-eating animals, is considerably addicted to ferocity, and always has been. But unlike most carnivora, his ferocity is mainly directed against his own species. That is a peculiarity of the species to which we have the misfortune to belong. I think that in the past, although people have been as ferocious as they knew how to be, and have done each other as much harm as they could, there were limits to their skill, and the harm they could do each other was not enough to wipe out the species. But now things are different. Now that same degree of ferocious feeling, which has always existed, is capable of wiping out the whole human race. And we've got to face, therefore, that unless we can learn to feel less hatred of each other, we cannot go on. The race cannot survive unless it learns a greater degree of toleration and of mutual kindliness. I think that perhaps it may be that if there were a nuclear war tomorrow, some people would survive. I believe that there would be people still perhaps in Patagonia and the Falkland Islands. There might be some survivors if there were a war tomorrow. But you've got to remember that unless we can stop the habit of war, scientific skill will go on inventing worse and worse things. You will have bacteriological war, chemical war. You will have H-bombs more destructive than those we have now. And there is very little hope for the future of the human race unless we can manage to find some way of putting an end to this mutual destructiveness, which now can no longer achieve any of the objects that in the past some ferocious men did achieve. We need new ways of thinking and new ways of feeling. Both, feeling just as much as thinking. We need to learn to think of other human beings as potential allies and not as active enemies. We need to learn not to hate. It's a difficult lesson after all the millennia during which we have allowed our bad passions to run rampant. But we've got to learn it if we want the human race to continue. I think this is a gradual matter. I don't think we can hope that the habits of many thousand years can be changed in a moment. And I think we shall have to approach the matter slowly. And those of us who feel strongly will have to learn not to be discouraged by the slowness of our success. I feel convinced that we can succeed, and I think it's only a question of going on and on, putting the case, putting it to everybody, to all and sundry at every possible occasion. And I think in that case we shall win over mankind to allow itself to go on existing. In the meantime, the only thing that we can do until we've converted the governments of the world, the only thing we can do is to try to find expedients to prevent the world from stumbling into war accidentally, as it easily may do if present policies continue. I think the danger of a great nuclear war is much greater than the governments of the world allow us to know. They must themselves know, but they don't want us to know, because if we did, we should say we won't have any more of this policy, it won't do. And so they try to keep us quiet and keep us ignorant and contented. Now, there are all sorts of ways in which a great war might begin. You know, of course, that there are missiles carrying H-bombs, there are planes carrying H-bombs floating about at any moment ready to go off. Now, take perhaps not a very probable thing, but a possible one. One of these might meet a meteor and blow up. Well, of course, it could be supposed that that was not a meteor, but an enemy missile. And instantly there would be general nuclear war. It's the policy is based upon this argument that the attacker will have an enormous advantage, and therefore each side assumes that the attack will come from the other side. We in the West say, oh, we should never attack, never, never. And the Russians say, oh, of course, we should never attack, never, never. But each side thinks the other will. And so we have to have instant readiness. The idea is that everybody must be ready at any moment to fire off an H-bomb. And you can't wait for orders from Washington or London or Moscow, because it's assumed that they will be wiped out already, and that therefore you can't have central direction. And somebody on the spot will have to say, oh yes, go ahead, and then perhaps from an entire misconception, there's a general war in which we all perish. Now, of course, you will say, well, meeting a meteor is not very probable. I agree, it isn't. But there are a great many other ways in which things might occur. There might, for instance, be a mistake in reading radar signals. That is quite a possible thing, a purely technical mistake, which might make people think that an enemy attack was coming along. Well, there again, they would reply instantly, because it's understood you can't wait. If you wait, you will be destroyed yourself. You have to go in at once. And so it might easily happen. Then there's another possibility which I think we must face, and it is this. The people who have the control of these terrible weapons have a constant nervous strain, especially since they've been told everywhere that they can't, in an emergency, rely upon orders from headquarters, but must act on their own initiative. I think that nervous strain is very likely to drive somebody over the edge to the point where he goes a little mad. And if one single man in charge of one of these weapons goes mad, the whole world goes up. It's a terrible risk that we're running from day to day. And I think if people realized how great the risk is, they would say we must have some other sort of a policy. On the contrary, instead of saying, let us make the risks less, the governments of the world are saying, let us make them greater. They're doing everything in their power to increase the risk of general war. I say this quite deliberately, because the policy is, at present, to give the H-bomb to other powers besides the three that at present have them. The H-bomb is desired by France and Germany, by Sweden and Switzerland. They are all, if present policies continue, pretty sure to have them before long. And can you suppose that if they have them, China will be content to be left out? Obviously not. And if you give it to all these, why not to everybody? And before you know where you are, you will find that every state in the world has its H-bombs, and that will enormously increase the danger of unintended general war. And that is one of the great objects that we have in view, to prevent the spread of H-bombs to powers that don't have them at present. And in order to secure that end, we say Britain ought to be willing to give up the H-bomb which it at present has. You will say this, you will realize that there's another danger when H-bombs are spread all over the world. It is the danger of mutiny in some one of these countries. It is just conceivable that the government may not be wholly wise. Such things have occurred. Now, you may get resistance to a government which is not wholly wise. You may get mutiny. You may get resistance to the mutiny. You will in that way very likely get the whole war started. I don't know how many of you remember that the First World War was entirely started by a certain terrorist organization in Serbia. And a terrorist organization that got hold of an H-bomb, well, there you are, that's the end. And that is very likely to happen if you allow these H-bombs to spread all over the world. I read an article in the Bulletin of the American Scientists, of the Atomic Scientists, an American magazine which tells you what scientific people in America think. This article is by Professor Oriar, who is professor of physics at Cornell University. And he goes into the question of the risk of war very carefully indeed, and concludes that within the next 10 or 20 years, war is much more probable than not if present policies continue. He says our present policy involves a practically infinite risk. I don't think anybody who goes into it can deny that. And I do quite seriously believe, and I should like you all to believe too, that unless the governments of both East and West change their line of policy, the human race will not exist at the end of the present century. I say that quite deliberately, and I think it's a very terrible thing to contemplate. Now, you know, governments are optimistic or pessimistic, as may suit their purposes. We can't believe the pronouncements of governments. Take this question of the tests. There are two vexed questions about the tests. The one is how much harm is done by fallout, and the other is how possible is it to detect tests. Now, on the former question, the governments are optimistic. They say, oh, it doesn't do very much harm, you know. Of course, yes, thousands of children will be idiots, but after all, what of that? We can't be bothered with a little thing like that. And they take altogether a very optimistic view about the harm done by fallout. But when you come to the detecting of tests, they take a pessimistic view. They say, oh, no, I know that the scientists all agreed that you could detect them, but what of that? We can't believe what the scientists say. And so on that, they're pessimistic. And they always take the view that encourages mass murder. It's a terrible thing about governments, but they will not believe the things that are necessary to believe if you're going to take sane measures to prevent this appalling Holocaust with which we are threatened. We don't support the atheistic communism. Russia got to your traitor. Empire will be subject to a traitor. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, a traitor. Yes, quite so. Well, now, look here. do you think is the greater traitor? The man who wishes to see some people left alive in this country, or the man who pursues a policy that means that they must all die? No. If there are any traitors, it's the people who want us to go on with this suicidal policy, not the people who want it stopped. We have to stop all war, and that is a thing that people have got to realize. Even if we had the immeasurable measure of success, that we got all H-bombs, all atomic weapons destroyed, and an agreement to inspect each other so that they weren't revived, even then, if a war should break out, each side would, of course, at once set to work to manufacture nuclear weapons. And so you won't be safe until you've got some method by which you can prevent war from occurring at all. That's a long job. Some people say, and I dare say the gentleman who accused me of being a traitor might be one of them, some people say that it's a cowardly thing to want to survive. Heroes face death with equanimity. They don't mind dying for a cause. I'm quite prepared to die for a cause if it's going to do any good, but I don't quite see the nobility of saying that everybody else is to die too. Do you think that, now let us take a concrete case. Suppose that a nuclear war broke out. Well, it's pretty certain that they would spare at least one bomb from Manchester. And if a bomb were dropped up in the center of Manchester, everybody who was in the street would be killed at once. But the less fortunate people who were indoors would probably have some hours or days or perhaps even weeks of intolerable agony and would die at last just the same. And do you think really that as you watched your children dying and realized that that was the end of all hope, do you think you would feel you'd been heroic for bringing that about? I don't. It doesn't seem to me a good form of heroism at all. I think there's one more thing I want to say, and that is a more hopeful thing. I don't think that we should let ourselves be hypnotized by fear of the terrible things that may happen. We should also dwell, and dwell even more, upon the good things that are entirely possible if once this terror was swept away. If you could get the world to agree that the interests of different nations, 9/10 at least of their interests, are identical, and only the remaining 1/10 is not. Consider first of all the interest of survival. That is a matter which we all have in common. We all perish or we all survive. And take again other things. Take industry and agriculture and art and science and all the whole host of things in which, if once people stopped hating each other, they would see that their interests are identical. We are blinded by competition and by the bad emotions that competition produces. If only we could realize that we are all one family with one identity of interest, and if East and West could come to feel that, there would be a possibility of a new joy in human life, such as there has never been since man began. There would be a possibility of real happiness, real flowering of the human spirit, and we could devote ourselves to the good things that man is capable of, instead of this devilish business of inventing ways of mass destruction. I think there is a possibility a possibility which is perhaps made greater by the horribleness of modern weapons. There is a possibility that men may come to realize their common interests and the futility of the strife that has existed hitherto. And I think if that should happen, the world will enter upon a period of splendor and happiness and joy such as has never existed since there were men on this earth.